Hey everyone, and welcome to the Livin' for Food Pod. I'm your host, Olivia Bria. This week, I have the wonderful Jash Mehta for you. Jash is the co-owner and founder of Poppin' Bottle, a brand that offers plant-based lattes and super concentrated coffee with no refined sugar, no additives, and sustainable ingredients. We love that. We chatted everything from building a business from the ground up to her prediction for this year's coffee trends. Just a little update on my end. There will be a few more episodes, and then I will be taking a little break during the summer season so that I can schedule the best and most captivating guest for you coming in the fall. So stay tuned for that, and please welcome and joining me, the wonderful Jash Mehta.
1, 2.
Thank you for coming on, and it's great to see you again, too. For those listening, me and Jash, we met when I was invited to a very lovely press trip in Ojai, California. It was very quick, overnight kind of thing, slept in a caravan, got a tarot card reading. It was a lot of fun, so glad to have you back.
thank you so much, Olivia. It's so nice to see you again, and I'm really excited to chat to you in this way and be on this.
Of course. Yeah, me too. I'm excited to get more into your company and all of that. But before we dive into all that, I want to kind of talk about you a little bit more. What were you doing before you invested your company in Poppin' Bottle? You grew up in the UK. What did food and meals look like for you as a kid?
You know, it's really interesting. Growing up in the UK is actually like part of what has brought me to health and wellness in the US, interestingly. Mm. And I grew up just outside of London. I grew up in kind of the suburbs of London. I loved growing up there. It was a great place to grow up. The UK isn't the biggest kind of food producing nation with the climate that we have, especially back then, you know, because I've been in the US for about 11 years now. So, you know, this was a different phase of time and different culture in the UK as well. Food culture has definitely moved on since then. Mm-hmm. But when I grew up, my experience of food in the UK was, I mean, reputationally, was not known for great restaurants. London, it's amazing now, it wasn't back then. Mm-hmm. But also, there was just kind of a disconnect between the way food is grown and where it's grown and purchasing it in the grocery store. We would go to the grocery store, everything was imported, it would be covered in, like, you know, plastic wrap. Moving to California, when I did, kind of in my like second half of my 20s, that was just a really stark contrast. I moved to San Francisco in kind of the height of the wellness, exponential wellness culture. Also mm-hmm. early part of kind of a big trend up in the plant-based movement. And also just the farm to table culture that exists in California, the amazing grocery stores, the farmers markets, so much being grown in the state. It just really kind of connected me to that experience more than I had had growing up in the UK. So yeah, the kind of contrast between the two actually was what got me really excited about food and also wellness.
That's one of the reasons I'm really enjoying California as well, is how much farm to table there really is. You know, sometimes it gets a bad rap because they're so healthy, quote, over here. But it's more just about like filling your body with organic ingredients and understanding what is on the labels of things that you're buying.
Totally.
I actually just got back from a trip from London, which was my first time there.
Amazing.
I did a lot of the tourist stuff. But as far as the food goes, the Thai food was really, really good.
It does. There are definitely, I mean, the one thing about, it's a little bit like New York in the sense that it's just such a melting pot of cultures, and also just geographically where it's located and its history. There's just so many interesting subcultures, and so that fabric, like how that weaves into the food culture, is really amazing. Yeah. Like the Indian food, like I'm South Asian, and Indian food is so amazing in the UK, as is kind of other pockets of ethnic food. And so, yeah, I love that aspect of it, and I think that I'm lucky to be, you know, I have access to that here as well, but there is something really cool about that in the UK, and just kind of the number of options as well in London in particular.
There are. It's kind of like, it reminded me of New York in a way that it's very much melting pot for sure. Different types of restaurants and foods. And of course I had to stop by the touristy markets, but
totally.
You know, sometimes they're touristy for a reason. Like Borough Market was definitely overwhelming in terms of like the people and everyone yelling about the food, but like the food was so good.
I love Farm Market.
Oh my god, I loved it.
Yeah. I'm so glad you went there. I used to actually work in a big corporate office like 5 minutes from there. And so
Oh, really?
We would sometimes go there for lunch. It was so fun.
I would go there like every day if I was you, because like I was clocking every single thing I wanted to try. I can only eat so much in like an hour, but we got the, they're very viral now, which I get why, but the strawberries and chocolate, which were really, really just fresh and good. A little on the pricier side, but that's to be expected.
That's awesome. Yeah, I have such good memories of going to that market. Yeah, it's lovely.
It is. We got like some sandwiches. They were passing out cheese. I was like, food markets are just my heaven personally. So that's why I love it so much. But anyways, tangent on food markets. You went on to study at the London School of Economics. Was there a sense that being an entrepreneur was what you wanted to do early on, or what was kind of the feel on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the short answer is yes. It wasn't necessarily, I mean, I think all of these things are building blocks, you know, like where you grew up, mm-hmm. what you experience, who your parents are, like all of these things. And so I do think that going to the London School of Economics and having that experience was one building block in that journey. But fast forward before that, kind of the, I think the biggest piece of that puzzle for me was my parents are both entrepreneurs, and my mom especially, mm-hmm. breadwinner in my family, kind of self-taught, never went to college, self-taught entrepreneur, really hustled, really, really hardworking and smart woman. And so just seeing that every day, you know, coming home from school and seeing her work really hard and seeing her take a lot of really important financial decisions in our household, and have the confidence mm-hmm. to do that. And also just giving, she gave us so many opportunities because she worked so hard. And mm-hmm. so that I think was probably the kind of biggest puzzle in my life that kind of made me think, you know, I want to kind of model after her and do that too. She did it in a completely different industry, not food and beverage related at all. But I just saw what it took to do that. I saw what it looked like to take risk and for mm-hmm. like taking risk to kind of be the fabric of our home. Yeah, that was kind of a really big part of my journey. And then I went to the LSE. I studied economics. One, the LSE is really international, so it's just really fun way to get to meet people from all over the world. And it does have a very entrepreneurial kind of part of its DNA, because, you know, people are studying economics and going into finance or going into entrepreneurship or consulting. There are lots of entrepreneurs that come out of that university. And so you kind of get connected to the world while in being part of a university like that. And it definitely added to my desire to do that. And it was a great experience. I can't say that what I actually like physically learned it has been relevant to me, but the experience
I get that.
Yeah.
I get that. I'm like, I don't remember what I actually learned in college, but I do know that it helped launch my career.
I think it did something right. Can't tell you exactly what, but yeah.
Yeah, I probably can't tell you like the dates of any history I learned, but I could tell you that I joined a food club, and that's how I got interested in food. So.
All important things, right?
Yeah, it all comes around for sure. For your mom too, I'm curious if, because you watched her being such an entrepreneur growing up, if taking risks, it was almost like a safety net for you to know that she took risks. Because I feel like people who don't come from self-starter families or necessarily like entrepreneurial families, taking risks is a bigger, for lack of better terms, is a bigger risk. Totally. But I wonder if like having that person in your family, you kind of felt like there was a safety net to be like, if you fail, it's going to be fine.
I think getting extremely comfortable with failure, little failures, you know, small things not going right, you know, small losses to big failures, honestly, are kind of a prerequisite to having the resilience to start a company. You can build that resilience on the job for sure. But I think it's really helpful to see that resilience modeled for you from a young age. I think that, and I'm not saying that I don't like have lots of feelings when we don't do things well, you know, I definitely do. Mm-hmm. I have all of that anxiety that comes with failure, but
tell me about it.
But I do think that what it teaches you is that you can still like, I learned that I will still have those feelings, but am mm-hmm. I still gonna like wake up the next day and put one foot in front of the other. Yeah, I'm still going to do that. I'm going to like have the experience and then I'm going to wake up the next day and march on. And the marching on is really, really the important part. And she definitely showed me that every day that, you know, things happen, you move forward. And mm-hmm. like, that is just part of what it means to be in this process. I think that that was really helpful as a child to see, not just when it comes to a company, but just as an important skill in life. Mm-hmm. Things won't go well at work. You'll like, things will be hard at your job. You will have to do all these like adult things and it's okay. And so, yeah, I do think that seeing that very early and seeing it through my adult life as well, because yeah, I mean, she's still doing amazing things today, is really helpful. Mm-hmm. And it's also really helpful as a sounding board. Like anytime I have a work-related problem that I just need to like speak to someone about, you know, she's a great resource. And so, yeah, I think that that was a really, really helpful part of growing up for me.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm glad you said that too, because I was going to ask you if she was someone who aided you along the way of your business. But even just as far as life goes, you moved from London to San Francisco, which is a huge, like 180. That's a big turnaround. I mean, was there anything about the culinary industry here that surprised you or you took note of, maybe even a culture shock kind of thing?
Yeah, great question. You know, it was all so new. That newness was actually really interesting and exciting, which is, you know, a huge mm-hmm. part of why we ended up building this company. I would say that the newness was all very positive. I loved, especially in San Francisco, actually, there's just, I mean, mm-hmm. so many cities have this, so many places have this, but my experience of it, having come from London to San Francisco, I would meet all of these other entrepreneurs in the food space. We, you know, we were itty bitty, teeny tiny, and I would meet others, yeah. you know, female entrepreneurs doing coffee companies as well, like, you know, cool coffee shops. There's a bunch in San Francisco, oh, yeah. or someone starting like a granola bar, or someone starting, you know, something in the food and wellness space. And it was really, like, it was kind of a really wonderful community and it was supportive, which was really cool. The ones that were not teeny tiny, they were a few years ahead, were helpful. And it was good to see yeah. that, you know, we can get there. I think that was all very exciting and different and encouraging. The one thing I would say business culture wise, so this is not specific to food, but I would say business culture wise, being in the US, this is not a San Francisco specific thing, but just being in the US versus being in the UK, was helpful. I think that there is a really wonderful entrepreneurship culture here that feels a little different, you know, mm-hmm. from a macro level, you know, being encouraged to like follow the American dream is, you know, a thing that mm-hmm. exists, of course.
The thing.
And, yep. But then on the micro level, it's little people like helping you with questions, responding to your emails, connecting you with somebody that like might have something that's helpful to you, and or just being kind of a support network. I think that that exists here in a way that's really exciting. And so, I especially in those early days, that really helped, and that really helped you kind of understand things quickly or sidestep things. And I noticed that to be a really wonderful thing. And then there's all these organizations, whether it was farmers market organizations or small markets or little things like that, that also was really helpful. Because we started in an extremely grassroots way where we were, you know, bottling the product on weekends in a small bottling facility in the East Bay and doing deliveries ourselves and, you know, things like that. So we were very much part of this small entrepreneurs community.
That's really fun that you brought that up, because that's something I've noticed too, is, you know, not necessarily on the corporate macro level, but when you get down to like the nitty gritty of like even my business, Freelance Writers, you'd think we'd be really competitive because we're all trying to land stories and we're trying to do this and do that. But I've actually found how much we help each other. And we're like, oh, do you need this connect? We'll connect you with this person. Do you need this? Do you need advice? What are your rates? Right. What are our rates? And that's, you know, especially as a young writer, that's really, really helped me understand how things work and not be afraid to ask people how things work either, because most people are willing to help you and want to help you and want to see you succeed, especially when it comes, you know, to the baseline of being a female, whatever, entrepreneur, business owner, etc.
For sure. I totally agree with that. It can be lonely without that kind of support. I think that that is a really, really helpful part of work culture. Yeah. And I'm happy to hear that that exists for you too.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. It's something that surprised me. I mean, you always run into those
few that are like, you know, we'll write you off or whatever. But more often than not, there's always, it's a pretty a good industry. Before you started Pop and Bottle, was there anything else that, or any other ideas that you had before this one came about, or was this your first go?
This is not my first go. Okay. Yeah. Yes, I dabbled, I side gigged a bunch. Even when I like worked like a 40-hour job, I was like thinking about ideas and kind of working on ideas on the side. And it just was something that was always part of me. And it would be the kind of part of work that I really enjoyed, was ideating on concepts and ideas. And so I did a little bit before I did some side hustling on things before I kind of decided to do this full time and really put all my time into this. But also, even before we decided to do this full time, we didn't know that this would be the main gig. You know, we were learning and we were actually new to the food and beverage industry. So frankly, we were naive and that naivety helped us. But in the beginning, it was like, let's do this for 6 months and let's see what traction we get. Let's see what feedback we get. And then if in 6 months, you know, we're seeing some traction and it's seeming positive, then we'll do the next 6 months. And so it was kind of, you know, exploratory in the beginning, especially because we were so new. But yes, I mean, I did do little fun side projects. One of them, which is kind of related, but not, we didn't create a food product, but I worked with chefs in the UK, chefs or like bakers in the UK, and we created online recipes, like almost like online cookbooks. Online, we'd have like a cool videographer come and record these lessons or these workshops, and then you could purchase almost like a
masterclass.
Yeah, almost like a very simple version of masterclass, but focused around chefs. That was really fun. It allowed me to kind of meet and dip my toe into the kind of food ecosystem and the chef ecosystem, which was which is really interesting and fun for me. And I got to be part of this part of content creation. You know, this is the world way before even like Reels or TikTok, right, where we would like produce this video content and it would get edited and it would be long form because some of these like workshops would be, you know, like 30-minute lessons, an hour lessons. People could purchase those and consume those. And that was my first food and bev related enterprise.
That sounds like a good time for me. Honestly, I love learning from chefs and stuff. So I could just video them cooking and then that's my job and I'll piece it together and post it. That sounds like
it was fun. I really enjoyed it. I learned a lot too. I learned how to decorate cupcakes way better than I ever expected to.
I will say that is my like one downfall is decorating cakes. I can't do it. I don't know what my issue is. I'm like, well, one, I need the patience for it, and that's something I can lack at certain times. But also, it's just I think I just don't have the patience to get the right tips for the frosting and things like that, so it just takes me a while. And then I don't have the hand for it. I can cook and I can bake, but when it comes to decorating the baked goods, it's not necessarily for me.
No, I have, it's so funny. So I have young kids. They're in this really sweet Montessori school where they do a lot of baking in school and and so they get to like decorate and they get introduced to all of these like baking and like cupcake things, and I sometimes think, oh my gosh, like I can't even do like what you can do. I hear you on the cupcake decorating. After we did this course, I realized that cupcake decorating is basically like an entire like huge thing of its own.
It's a skill. It's a skill you need to practice a lot. And I just don't have the patience to do it. It's like tedious tasks for me that I just can't sometimes.
Oh, totally.
But the frosting regular is fine. So I don't know. So you mentioned you have young kids. Are they watching and trying to emulate you in terms of, you know, food or self-starting or anything like that?
The short answer is no, but my hope is eventually yes. So my oldest is 6 and my youngest is 18 months. And I have a three-year-old who's in the middle. I have three girls. So I definitely have these grandiose ideas that they are going to see me as like a female entrepreneur and they're going to be really inspired and they're going to like really, I'm going to get a lot of credibility for this as a parent. So far,
as you should.
As I should. So far, that is not happening, but I have hopes that like maybe once we get to like 8, 9, when it all kind of makes a bit more sense, it will. I will say that it has been fun to take them to grocery stores and show them Pop and Bottle on the shelf. I could see the first time, I think my daughter was like 4 or 5 at the time, maybe 4. You know, I work from home. I work from my home office in the post-pandemic world. Okay. We do not have an office. We all work remotely. So their like view of their mom working is she sits in a room in the house and she sits on her computer. And so it doesn't make sense what I do. They just think, well, my 3-year-old, when she wants to like copy mama working, she just like pretends to be on a laptop. And like, it doesn't really make sense that like we put out a product or we do any of this stuff. So taking them to the store was helpful because that was when it first clicked, like, oh, like that thing that you do on the computer is related to this product landing in the store and people can buy it and then people can drink it. And it started to make sense. And I think when they're a teeny bit older, maybe when my oldest is like a couple years older, it'll be really fun to like take her to the factory and she can actually see it being produced and understand it a bit better. But yes, I hope that over time, as they kind of just understand the way things work, it'll be meaningful for them to see.
It will. When they get older and they actually understand what's going on a little more. It's so interesting, actually, that you brought up the work from home thing, because in my head, my dad would come home from work late or whatever, but he'd be out all day. And then, you know, same with my mom, and she still does teaches at a high school. But it's just interesting how now they're seeing, oh, no one's leaving. So what are you doing all day? And they can't really understand what's actually going on.
No, it's so true. It takes quite a bit of explaining. I think also one challenge as a working parent who works from home is that what they see, or at least with what I do, it's a lot of being on a computer all day, being on Zoom all day. And so when you're trying to educate them on like responsible technology use and not being on their iPad and not having a phone and being out in the world, it's a little tricky when they see you at home like on a computer all day
on it.
And so I do think, and I am excited to show them more of what I do beyond just like being on Zoom calls all day. And so yeah, seeing it in store, going to the factory, and then, you know, eventually what'll be really amazing, and we hope to do this as a team as well, is go to coffee growing regions. We buy from Central and South America a lot of our coffee, going and doing an origin trip and seeing how the coffee's grown and, you know, how people cultivate the farms and harvest and all of that great stuff. I think that'll be really educational. So we're not there yet, but yeah, hopefully that helps put all the pieces of the puzzle together for them.
No, that would be so super incredible too. I'm so interested in all that stuff and I love to see the origin of everything, because it just sometimes goes so over your head when you walk through the store and it's like you're grabbing your things and whatever else. You don't really think about the sourcing of any of it, which is what I get into a lot on here too. But you created this with your friend, Blair Hardy. Realized quickly there was not a lot of organic, not a lot of free of refined sugar, not a lot of sustainable options. I was reading through your Forbes interview from like a few years back, I think like 5 years back now, and it surprised me that the brand was not originally female focused. So what was the cause of that big shift?
So this is a great question. It wasn't that it wasn't female focused, it's that we didn't really realize it was as female focused as it was. And so it was kind of a like connecting the dots that happened like only a few years into building the brand. It was so, I guess like the reason why is because it was so organic to us, because we're two female founders. We were, you know, building a product, first of all, like developing a product that we wanted to drink that matched with our values, that we liked aesthetically, and, you know, a brand concept that like we were excited about. And because by virtue of who we are and what we cared about, we created something that we wanted to drink and we wanted to consume and we like wanted to get behind. And of course that meant that it like was it had like the metrics that were attractive to other people like us. But when you're in the weeds, just like in a room making a product, or like, you know, you sometimes don't see the forest from the trees. And it took a couple years of like getting it into stores, having people write us, seeing who was buying it organically, seeing which types of brand ambassadors wanting to work with us, like all of those types of things where we kind of understood that we had organically created something that was very naturally aligned with the female consumer without knowing it was
intentional.
Yeah, it's like we didn't have a brand book day one that said we are going to make a female focused coffee brand and this is the kind of demographic that we are catering towards. It was like we're building a product that we love and it's important to us. Then we did see the forest from the trees. We zoomed out and we were like, oh, I get why we exist now. And I get who we're, I get which consumer we're bringing into the space that was not served before in the way that, you know, we, you know, where we thought there's a white space. And then that was a really helpful realization because, of course, as a brand, you need to know why you exist in the form of your consumer. But also as you're looking to grow the brand, it really helped us further define why we were doing what we were doing. And also as we, when it came to innovating and adding new products, you know, which we have done now several times since we launched our very first set of products back then, it really helped us make sure that what we were doing made sense in the context of the customer we were serving and what she wanted. And it's not that only women consume Pop and Bottle. That's absolutely not the case, but it's just that it just organically aligns with that consumer. And that consumer happens to be a very important, you know, purchaser of food items in the household and also cares about wellness and all of those good things. And so they might be purchasing it, they might be bringing it home and the rest of their household is consuming it, but they are kind of making those purchase decisions based on their values. So yeah, that was kind of the dot connecting that we did over the course of the brand.
Yeah, I mean, and you said it too, you really have to find where you fit into the space. And you know, being female owned in a food and beverage space where, you know, a lot of women are often underrepresented, but I feel like now that's, you know, coming to a head kind of at some point, because just the amount of female entrepreneurs I've spoken to, especially in the culinary space, but then also targeting, you know, mostly millennial women, or at least slightly heavily, more heavily. Mm-hmm. What were your challenges, if any, that came with that?
Gosh, great question. I mean, one thing I think is it's a fine line between knowing who you're serving and being really aligned with that consumer, but not isolating any other consumer. And I don't think that we have gotten, I don't think we've gotten dangerously close to that line at any point. But I do think that that is like the one risk, is if you are really trying to attach to one demographic, you want to make sure that, you know, in order to have business success, that you, of course, are appealing to as many people as possible and bringing people into the brand. And so I do think that's important. And also access is a really important part of what we're doing. And what I mean by that is we didn't want to just make a product that had all of these great virtues, but then only had the affordability where you could only buy in like very high-end stores or only certain parts of the country and not others. And so as we've grown, we've really worked on increasing access, one, by just getting distribution in lots of different places, geographies, types of markets, et cetera, et cetera. And then also making sure that as we scale, we passed on all of those price breaks to the consumer so that the product in itself has become a lot more affordable over time. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, again, I think that the goal is to appeal to our, to the values of our core customer always, but to have broad access and to appeal to a broad set of people who also want to have clean products and also want to be able to have organic coffee and also value clean eating, which, you know, that group is only getting bigger over time. So you know who you are, but you also learn to evolve and grow. And I think that's always the balance of what we're doing.
That's an interesting point too, because you're trying to aim towards the audience that wants it and it caters to, but the exact word you said is you don't want to isolate other people or potential target audience members. It's interesting to kind of have to balance that as an entrepreneur, to like find your voice in your brand, but then also try to expand to other markets and, like you said, make it more accessible. And I know you're available in Target now, which is really, really cool, right? That was new, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, it's reasonably new. We launched with one product line with them in the fall, and then which is our lattes, our canned lattes, and then we launched with our large organic coffees with them in spring of this year. So yeah, we've been working on that for a while, so super excited to be partnering with them.
That's awesome. Yeah, I remember chatting about that too. What's your biggest seller? That's something I'm always curious.
Yeah, great question. It probably won't surprise you, because if you go to a coffee shop, it's one of the most ordered things. And especially if you ask people in our demographic, it's often most of the most important ordered things. But it's our vanilla latte is our most popular. You know, everyone likes vanilla. and of course, the latte product is our bread and butter product. So yeah, that's our most popular. And everybody has a different way that they like their coffee, but I think that one is the one that fits into kind of the broadest group of people.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not surprised by that. That's a solid one to always grab towards. Did you consult any chefs during this project, or was this just you and your friend that created?
So I joke that we like literally developed this in our kitchen. That is actually true. of course, pre-commercializing anything, but when we were trying to figure out what we liked and what the taste of what we liked, and also how what we were making was different or unique, we literally had a Vitamix in my apartment, and we would buy like bulk organic ingredients, and we would spend hours recipe testing. And again, same point I made about being a little bit naive, we didn't really know what it meant to like commercialize a product that, you know, had to be shipped around the country and had to have shelf life and needed to have packaging that didn't break, and like all the things, right, that didn't cost like $10 to produce, you know, like we didn't know any of those things. We were just like, we just want to make a delicious product that we want to drink every day. And so that's where we started. And we would, you know, in our little like my apartment / our test kitchen, we would hand press almond milk and cold brew coffee in like large vats, and you know, use cheesecloths to like filter the coffee, and you know, it was like extremely messy and crazy, but we did 95% of the recipe development literally in my apartment. And we came with base recipes that we loved. We got friends to taste them and give us feedback, and we use that to refine the recipes and et cetera, et cetera. And then, and I say like 95% because that was all the heavy lifting. And then as we started to scale, we needed to figure out, okay, this cannot just have a 7-day shelf life. Otherwise, we are going to be selling in 20 stores in San Francisco, and those are the only people that are going to be able to access it. So we had to innovate on process and do little refinements over time. But if you look at the ingredient panel for our almond milk lattes, which is our first product, that ingredient panel is the same ingredient panel that of the product we developed in my kitchen.
That's crazy.
The naivety actually really helps, because if we had taken the traditional route of developing a commercial product, we would have had to bring in a R&D group. They would have told us, you can only do it this way. You have to add these ingredients. This is just the way it's done. And we would have felt like, oh, we can't do this. Let's move on. This is not doable. And that would have been the story.
That's the end.
but anyway, it helped that we didn't know that. And so we had a base product. And then the question became, hey, we need to keep this product exactly the way it is. So we just need to find ways to grow this in a way that keeps the product integrity the way it is. And, you know, eventually we figured that out. Was it way slower? Yes, it was way slower. It took us years to like figure out, like, again, just one foot in front of the other, growing slowly. Like we went from 7 days of shelf life to 3 weeks, and so on and so forth. Because we didn't like have all the answers, and we had to take time. So yes, it definitely slowed down the journey. I wouldn't recommend it if you're interested in scaling something extremely quickly. But we learned a lot, and most importantly, we kept the product integrity.
You know, I was talking to another founder in the beverage business. She founded Poppy, which is like the quote, like better for you soda brand. She did it right in her kitchen too.
I know. I love those stories. I love those stories, and I love those entrepreneurs. And I, of course, relate to them a lot too. But a lot is doable, and you just figure it out. you can figure it out.
That's my motto in life. I'll just figure it out and it'll all work out. Sometimes it doesn't, but sometimes it does.
If it doesn't, you learn something along the way and it's fine.
There you go. Everything's a life lesson. I just would prefer not to have as many life lessons in a row, but you know.
Very fair. We'll space them out.
Yeah, exactly. I want to take more of a macro lens for a minute because, you know, you're in the sustainable food industry and I have an interest in that. What is the first thing that comes to mind that you think like we, and I'm talking like me, general America, sustainability can do better as a whole in the food and beverage industry?
Gosh, that's a great question. I guess a few things come to mind, but there is definitely a lot of education that, I mean, we've come a long way. I think that in terms of recyclability, in terms of where things are being sourced, in terms of ingredients, like I think we've really come a long way, but we still have a long way to go. And I think a lot of education is still needed. And there is a role in kind of really responsible education in the media, social circles, in social media, in kind of all of these places, and especially with people that have platforms and people that have a voice to continue. And this is a journey, right? We'll be on it for a long time, but to continue to do that, I think I remember when we, so this is one example that comes to mind, when we were developing Bomb Bottle, I think we were a couple years in market. And California had been in drought at that time. We were in, you know, a couple years into a long drought. There was a lot of noise, for lack of a better word, at the time about almond growing and its water use. And that's a really important conversation. One that as someone who makes a product with almond milk, right, that's a really important thing for one, for us to be educated about. And then two, for us to kind of think responsibly about, you know, our role in that and how we can make sure that we're doing the best we can about that. But I remember it was very buzzworthy at the time. A lot of people, when I was pitching for investment and when I was selling the product into places, I would get that question. I don't get that question anymore, but at the time, because it was so newsworthy, I would get that question. Like,
do you get it about oat milk now?
I think all of, you know, everything, whether it's dairy, oat, almond, everything has its pros and cons, right? This is unfortunate. Right. Unfortunately, there's like no one like perfect product with anything, like in anything in life.
No.
So everything has its moment in the spotlight. And back then it was the almond milk. And I remember, you know, people asking me, and I get the question a lot, doesn't growing almond take like gallons of water? Like, doesn't growing one almond take gallons of water? And that was not false information. That was true. But the broader part of the conversation was so much more deep and so much more nuanced, because that is a lot of water, but also compared to dairy milk, that is very little water. And so, and I'm not, this is not a criticism of dairy milk either. Like, everything has pros and cons, but I guess my point is that, these things kind of ebb and flow. More education that's broader, that starts earlier, around all of these important things, I think is really important, because we as a collective society, we want to make good choices, right? Like, for the most part, we are all really well-intentioned consumers. We just kind of need to have the right information to be able to make the best choices. And so I think there's a big role in that to play. And so, yes, I guess I'm sure I can think of many others, but I think education has a really big role in the sustainability conversation.
It does. It really does. And I can't speak to the school system now, but this is something I wish I learned a little bit more early on versus getting educated like late college, even just now out of college. It's something that I'm trying to do, especially too, as a journalist. It's like, you know, currently I'm writing a story for a big health magazine. And, you know, at first I was getting frustrated because I was like, they want me to have like this many experts and they want me to like do this. And it's taking so much longer. But I was like, I actually really, really appreciate that I'm using so many people for their knowledge and things like that to corroborate exactly what I'm writing versus just like, you know, pulling something out of thin air and writing it and publishing it. It's kind of the same thing with learning about, you know, sustainability or broader topics or your food sourcing. It's like, we need to take a microscope to it, but also, you know, comparing it to things like dairy milk and almond milk is, you know, there's the pros and cons where you sometimes you just look at the cons. It's just very like,
totally.
It's hard to navigate. And I wish I had more of that education earlier on in life versus now.
Totally.
That was a big tangent.
Yeah, but. No. These are inherently really hard problems. You know, it's really hard to distill mm-hmm. them into quick solutions. It's also really hard to kind of create black and whiteness in them, right? Like
right.
We're just living in the gray. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I hope that as a collective society, we are just kind of moving further along, you know, together. But yeah, it's really hard. All of these decisions and all of these questions are nuanced and complicated.
They are very, very nuanced and complicated. That's why everyone gets so mad about it all the time. All right, so I have a short game for you, if you're up for it. It's basically, I'm going to say food trends and you're going to tell me if you're for or against them.
Okay.
This is all coffee oriented because I felt like that made sense.
Okay, love it.
So first one, drinking iced coffee in the winter.
Oh, 100% for it. Love it.
Mm-hmm. Me too. That's like eating ice cream in the winter and I still do 100%. That, so.
I know I live in California, so I have the benefit of, you know, that night. Not being crazy,
true.
But I think that even if I lived in New York or yeah, other places, I would Minnesota even, I would do it.
Minnesota. Okay, if anyone from Minnesota is listening, let me know if you do that or not. All right, second one. This was a viral trend on TikTok recently, whipped coffee. Did you see that?
You know, I have to say I'm into it. And the reason why is because I love all the innovation. I love all the TikTok content and I enjoy it, so I'm for it.
All right, cool. And then the third one, I already know your answer, but I'm going to do it anyways. Cold brew.
Oh, also for it.
I figured you kind of had to be.
I love the taste of cold brew, and I love that it's like different to, you know, just iced coffee or other forms of brewing. Mm. But for my personal taste profile, I really enjoy it. So yes, definitely for it.
All right. Fourth one, which I don't know if you've seen. I don't know if it's really out of the ordinary, but adding crushed eggshells to coffee grounds before brewing.
Wow. Okay. I'm actually not familiar with this. So
yeah, it's a new thing.
Oh, okay. No, I have not heard of it. And so I guess NA can't comment.
Undecided. It's supposed to brew, like it's supposed to reduce bitterness, I guess, in your coffee.
Okay.
But I guess it also could just be another way to use, you know, eggshells, food sustainability kind of thing. So I'm curious about it.
No, I cannot say I've tried it. But yes, I will definitely look into it.
Interesting. All right. Fifth one, espresso martini.
Love. Love an espresso martini. It's definitely, it's like my drink of choice when I'm out. And yes, this was a big trend in London growing up, having espresso martinis. And
oh, was it?
Yeah. And I think that it migrated here later. But yes, I'm an OG espresso martini fan.
That's so funny. I didn't know that. See, to me, it's like I'm scared to mix alcohol with coffee.
I think that's a very fair concern. I'm someone who drinks a lot of coffee, and so having espresso at night is like not a problem for me. but if that is not you, I would not recommend it.
Yeah, not me. Honestly, and alcohol puts me to bed, and then I'll end up waking up, and then it's like something confusing is happening in my brain.
For sure, yeah.
All right. My final question for you, I normally do like a chef question, but I changed it up for you a little bit. What do you think is or is going to be the biggest coffee trend of 2024?
Ooh, great question. I think interesting flavors paired with coffee are going to continue to be a really cool and fun trend. I'm seeing, you know, a lot of floral notes in coffee, which I personally love. Also, like berry notes in coffee, which I also like.
Oh.
It's not obvious, but actually can be delicious. A raspberry mocha, delicious.
Oh.
Yeah, I think that there's like a cool berry coffee, maybe mocha pairing that is tasty. But yes, I think. Especially like millennials, Gen Z, like we, you know, as collective groups, you know, are increasingly loving different flavors paired with coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that trend will continue. I think it'll start to become more interesting, maybe a bit more culinary. I'm here for all of it.
Ooh, the berry notes one is interesting. I'll have to see how that plays out a little bit, because you always have like the teas that do really well. I just had like a green mango lemonade tea or something recently, and then like lavender and stuff. So I'm interested to see how that kind of filters into coffee.
Yeah, you might start to notice. Well, if you have like a favorite coffee shop that does good seasonal flavors, look out for it. I've seen like raspberry mocha is one that I've tried recently, which I thought was really good. You know, strawberry mocha, it'll too. Yeah, I think that as with anything, they can be done really badly and they can be done really well. So hopefully you'll try a good one. But yeah, I tried one recently and I thought it was really great.
I'm really, really into chai lattes. And now I'm like craving them. And I think that was my mistake that I kept drinking them.
I mean, that's awesome.
They're just so good. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the cinnamon. I don't know.
They're so good.
They're very good.
It's kind of like a year-round like pumpkin spice, you know, it's like
true,
delicious and spice forward and yeah, sweet,
iced or hot,
iced
too.
Or hot. Yeah, oh yeah, love them both.
It's so good. All right, so now that we're wrapping up, does the company or you have any other upcoming projects, anything exciting coming up that we didn't talk about?
Yeah. So two things that I'm really excited about. One, I think I mentioned, but we just launched our organic cold brews and they're our first, it's the first time Pond Bottles doing a really large format. They're like large 48-ounce bottles. So,
Yeah,
I'm just excited that someone can have us in the fridge for 2 weeks. And if you're working from home or whatever you're doing, you have it there or you can customize it to how you like. So really excited about that. As someone who works from home, like I am really enjoying having that in my fridge. And it's hard to find organic options when it comes to that form of product. So, you know, we're excited to be providing one. And then the other one, which is coming soon, is this year we're doing seasonals for the first time. And so we're coming up with some fun fall flavors. You won't be too surprised what we come up with. Also winter flavors. Yeah. and so, yeah, I work on a lot of the R&D for the company still. A lot of the product development still sits with me. So I'm working on that at the moment pretty actively. So coming to a shelf near you fall 2024.
Yay, that's so exciting. I have to say, when I brought back some bottles from the press trip, I had given it to some of my friends who were like avid coffee lovers too, and they loved it. They really, really loved it. They were like, can you get me more of these? And I was like, well, she's gonna be my podcast, they're gonna send me some. And now it's in my fridge. I'm like, I saved some for you guys. I texted them.
Oh, that makes me so happy. I was so delighted to hear that.
Yeah, I know, they really enjoyed it. So keep doing what you're doing. You're honestly gonna be an amazing role model for your kids and stuff. And you know, everything you're doing has been so awesome. And I appreciate you coming on and chatting with me.
Thank you. I love chatting to you. And yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been fun.
Of course. You can follow Pop and Bottle on Instagram at Pop and Bottle, or check out their latest projects on their website, popandbottle.com. Hey, fellow foodies. Thanks so much for listening. And don't forget to leave me a review. While you're at it, make sure to follow me at livinforfoodpod on Instagram or TikTok, or email me at livinforfoodpod@gmail.com. Let me know what you're cooking up this week, which guests you would like to see on the podcast, or tell me your opinions on the latest viral food trend. And in case you're just joining me, there is an entirety of season 1 ready and waiting for you. Until next time.